Hello, my name is Aaron Lohr, and this is the Endocrine News Podcast. Recently, the Endocrine Society's Bone and Mineral Special Interest Group discussed the importance of fracture liaison services and how they contribute to an improved quality of life for patients and cost saving for the facility. An important part of the discussion revolved around a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled Coordinating Multidisciplinary Care, Improving Outcomes After Fragility Fractures. The article noted that despite the benefits of fracture liaison services, the lack of reimbursement for those services in the United States is a significant financial barrier, rendering the service underutilized. The article further states the global burden of hip fractures is expected to double over the next few decades. Are we looking at an impending crisis? What role should fracture liaison services play in reducing treatment gaps and improving post-fracture care? To help us answer those questions, my guests today are the three authors of that New England Journal of Medicine perspective. Joining me today are Dr. Nicola Napoli of Università Campus Biomedico in Rome, Dr. Peter Ebeling of Monash University in Australia, and Dr. Douglas Keel, the Marcus Institute for Aging Research at Hebrew Senior Life. Thank you all for being here today.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, before we talk about fracture liaison services, let's first talk about osteoporosis. What do we know about the impact of osteoporosis-related fractures for patients?
I think that's a good starting point, Aaron. Across the spectrum of chronic diseases that physicians and other healthcare providers are charged with managing, it seems that our osteoporosis patients are sometimes overlooked in comparison to, say, the attention given to some of the cardiovascular screenings that we do for hypertension and cholesterol. And then we have all the cancer screening. And at the bottom of the list is thinking about osteoporosis. So it's not surprising that sometimes the first sign of osteoporosis is when a patient has a broken bone. We call them fractures, but I advocate that we actually tell the patients that they broke a bone. It's a bone break, because fracture has different meanings to patients. They almost minimize its importance when you use a word like fracture. But needless to say, these broken bones have a tremendous impact. As you pointed out, just taking some statistics from 2019, the global number of new cases of fracture was about 178 million. That's across the world. And that value in 2019 was an increase of about 33% from where it was in 1990. And hip fractures are by far the most devastating types of fracture, leading to substantial mortality and, most importantly, threats to independent living of our older adult population. In fact, some types of qualitative research have quoted patients who sustained hip fractures as saying they would rather be dead than go through the period following a hip fracture. So it is quite devastating. And I think that is why it's surprising to some of us that not enough attention has been paid to these.
It's not only very difficult for the patient, but maybe for the health systems as well. What kind of strain does treating patients with fractures put on health systems?
If you're practicing medicine and you look at the cost of treating these fractures, again, hip fractures are some of the more expensive types because they require hospitalization, surgery, and they're often prolonged because of comorbidities that the patients come into the hospital with. But when I looked up a meta-analysis of 113 studies trying to estimate the cost of treatment in hospital for a hip fracture, in the US, it's been estimated to be about $10,000. But the total health and social care costs for a hip fracture
after 12 months following the fracture comes to about $43,000 and some change. So it is substantially costly. And in the United States, we have a very odd system of, I would call it fractured care, that may be less obvious in other countries that have more coordinated care across settings. We have the famous handoff system where the outpatient docs hand care off to the hospital where the hip fracture patient is cared for. Then upon discharge, the hospital doctors hand off the patients to the rehabilitation facilities. And then the final handoff is either to a nursing home if the patient does not recover adequately from the hip fracture, or returning home and completing the circle back to the primary care doc. So we have different systems all supposedly interacting to ensure continuity of care. And this lack of coordination is an underlying problem in the U.S.
So we've talked about several challenges already, and the one thing that might help address some of those challenges are fracture liaison services. So tell us more about those. What do they aim to do and how are they designed?
I would like to follow what Professor Keel was mentioning, the lack of a coordinated care in most of countries after a fragility fracture. And fracture liaison services aim to identify and provide care for patients with a fragility fracture in order to reduce the risk of another fracture. So are designed to bridge the gap between acute fracture care and the long-term management of osteoporosis. It's important here to mention, to highlight the treatment gap, because the majority, and we are talking about 80% of people after a fragility fracture, mostly after a hip fracture, do not receive any anti-osteoporosis treatment. And unfortunately, the end of the patients is often even the death. And it's basically the 20% of these people die within the first 6 months after a hip fracture. Or the other possibility is a long-term disability with a huge impact on the quality of life and also on the life of the caregivers. So these models have been used in other chronic care models, like for diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, or cancer, and they've been really successful. So we are trying hard with the ASBMR, with many other scientific societies, like International Osteoporosis Foundation or the other US-based foundations, to develop and to give more opportunities to patients to receive a more coordinated clinical approach through FLS.
It seems like fracture liaison services address important needs, but why are they underutilized?
You're right. Fracture liaison services are really effective. They reduce fractures by 74% in the first year and 32% in the second year, yet they're underutilized. And the reason for that is resourcing. What we need to identify is a sustainable funding model whereby these fracture liaison services can be employed in every health service. Some countries have done that at a country level, like Japan, or at a health service level in some states in Australia. And I think what we've been trying to do with ASBMR is to develop a model whereby we can create Medicare funding for the services provided by fracture liaison services. And this would really improve the care of our patients, but also result in cost savings for the health service.
Now, your perspective piece, the New England Journal of Medicine, mentions four different models of fracture liaison services. Why are there multiple models and how are they different?
Because every hospital, every institution has different approaches and different methods of care. So there are four different models that we may adapt according to different local situations. The type A model of care represents the coordinated approach to secondary fracture prevention. Patients are identified, assessed, and treated for osteoporosis as part of this all-encompassing service. In this case, the fracture liaison coordinator is the central figure, usually is a nurse called also champion. And this person has the role to coordinate several physicians, orthopedic surgeons, radiologists, the bone doctor, physical therapy, in order to improve the flow of the patient and to be sure that patients go home with a prescription and then follow the treatment that was prescribed during hospitalization. Then we have type B model that is less used, but different from type 1 because the treatment initiation is given to the primary care physician. And then we have a type C that basically people with fractures are receive some advice on lifestyle, including falls prevention advices. And the physicians, usually the FLS alerts the general practitioner of the person about the need for further assessment and treatment to reduce the risk of further fractures. While in type D, the intervention is just basically specific education, very general education about osteoporosis given to the patients and to the caregiver, but there is no treatment, there is no letter about the clinical situation of this patient that goes to the GP.
You mentioned earlier that fractional liaison services have a high efficacy. What do we know about the effectiveness of these services when it comes to patient care?
There are several evidence, also meta-analysis, showing the efficacy of this model in terms of reduction of mortality, adherence to treatment, reduction of fractures. And I would like to mention that fractures are reduced by 74% in the first year and 32% in the second year and beyond. But data are very strong also in terms of quality of life, reduction of falls, and in general, reduction of frailty.
Earlier, we talked a little bit about cost savings because we know that fracture liaison services require financial investment, but the perspective in the New England Journal of Medicine does mention, like you said, they can save money over time. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
The cost-effectiveness modeling shows that for every dollar invested, there can be an eventual saving of $10.49. So the reason for this, and this has been looked at private healthcare settings such as Kaiser Permanente in California, that if you employ this system to seek out patient with fractures and then prevent the next fracture over the next year or two, this results in cost savings associated with the treatment of these fractures, such as repairing hip fractures and the hospitalization and rehabilitation that's required. Also, the long-term costs, which are associated with institutionalized care for these patients after a hip fracture and also increased mortality. So if you put all of those things into a model, eventually these services are cost-saving. And that's why I think we really need to put resources into funding fracture liaison services for the benefit not only of our patients, but of the community more generally. And we can really save healthcare costs as well.
Now, other countries have successfully implemented fracture liaison services, but why is now the right time for healthcare systems in the United States to follow their example?
Being a geriatrician, most sensitive to the changing demographics, both in the United States as well as globally, with increased life expectancy, if you look at the percent of the population who are at different age groups, we have gone from a pyramid type of shape, a triangulation where very few individuals lived into advanced age and there were many more younger individuals. Now it's become a barrel and it's going to be a flipped over triangle where greater percentages of our global population will be in the older age groups. Although there's some evidence that the incidence of hip fractures are decreasing in some countries around the world, that fact is completely overwhelmed by this change in demographics. So even though for every 1,000 older adults, there'll be a certain number of fractures, and if that number goes down, you might think that there'll be less fractures. The fact is there are so many older adults in these older age groups, that even if the rate's going down slightly, the total number of hip fractures is going to be increasing in the U.S. and globally. So if we just keep following our traditional models without coordination of care, identifying the fractures, closing the gap on secondary prevention, and increasing the recovery success of these fracture patients, we will be facing an epidemic of fractures that's going to overwhelm the healthcare system. So I don't want to create a doomsday type of situation, but the fact is, with these changes in the population, the healthcare costs are going to really go through the roof. And that's the perfect setting to design and actually implement these fracture liaison services, because as you've heard today, they not only reduce subsequent fractures, but they save money. Now, there aren't too many investments in healthcare that can actually save money and reduce death and morbidity. When you find one of these, you should be implementing it without question. And we believe the fracture liaison services, they really meet those criteria. You've heard they save money and they reduce mortality and morbidity. I think that they haven't been widely used in the U.S. because there is an initial upfront investment. And our healthcare system in the U.S. has a very short perspective on and healthcare expenditures. Each part of this system that I referred to earlier is trying to reduce costs within that niche. But you have to look more globally at the whole healthcare system. That's why in the U.S., sometimes the adaptation of these services follows adequate reimbursement for the person power that is required to get the liaison champion that Nicola mentioned and to ensure that people get treated. So there is an upfront cost, but overall, it saves lives and saves money. Can't beat that.
When we treat a patient with osteoporosis after a fracture, we save a life. And I think this is a strong message that people should understand. Osteoporosis is not just a chronic disease that doesn't have any consequences. So treatment is not just poison for ONJ or for a typical femur fracture like in Europe, but everybody now is scared of being treated. When we treat, we save lives. And this is such an important message that I hope that people will get.
You make a very strong case. You've won me over, but we need to win some others over too. We're just about out of time today, but I wanted to thank my guests for having this conversation about fracture liaison services. And if you listeners appreciate what you've heard and you might work at institutions where this could be a benefit, please share it. And thank you, Dr. Napoli, Dr. Keel, Dr. Eberling, for being part of the podcast today. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye. Ciao, Doug.
See you.
That's all for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. As mentioned at the beginning, today's episode was inspired by some wonderful conversation taking place among the Endocrine Society's Bone and Mineral Special Interest Group. The special interest groups help Endocrine Society members connect year-round and share knowledge and insights in topics such as adrenal and pituitary, obesity, endocrine cancers, endocrine disrupting chemicals, and many more. If you'd like to join one or more of these vibrant communities, we'll include a link in today's episode description. We'll be back soon with another fascinating dive into the world of endocrinology. Until then, thanks for listening.
Endocrine News Podcasts are a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.